Thank you for joining us on Connecting the Diocese, a production of the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. My name is Jack Socia. We often hear the term hometown heroes. These can be people just in the private sector who do something wonderful for their neighbors. It could be a law enforcement or fire person who saves someone who's fallen through the ice. It could be all kinds of things. Hometown heroes, it's a wonderful thing. But something we almost never hear about are hometown martyrs. Martyrs are people who have either been killed because of their beliefs or killed in the process of doing something that is being done because of their beliefs. We have a local hometown martyr. We're going to be talking about him right after this on Connecting the Diocese. There is a lot of confusion and consternation going on, both in religious and nonprofit secular circles, regarding funding that they were expecting from the U.S. government that may or may not be coming. You can read all about the finger-pointing and all the confusion going on and all the changing things from day to day, but the short version of it is that a lot of various organizations that do get funding from the government to help other people who are in need are not getting the money, or at least they're saying it's being delayed while the entire picture of the government is being studied. It's important to understand that the reason that the government gives nonprofits, including religious nonprofits, money to serve people in need is because they have discovered that they can do it, that is, the nonprofits and the religious ones in particular, can do it more efficiently than the government can. Basically, they've already been there doing it. They're not starting from scratch. They know where all the nooks and crannies are and where all the help needs to be done and all the things that have to be done a certain way. But now, at least until things get straightened out as to what really is going on, they are in short supply, especially places like food banks, things like that. Now, the natural inclination would be to go buy some food and bring it over to your local food bank, and that's a great idea. However, if instead of buying the food and bringing it over there, you take the same exact dollar amount that you were going to use to buy the food and simply give it to the food bank, they can purchase more food than you can because they have special arrangements with distributors. Now, I wish I could tell you when all the confusion is going to end, but I cannot. What I can tell you is simply that there are going to be a lot more people needing food and going to food banks, and so the strain is going to be quite intense. Even you or someone you know may need to go there and try to stock up your refrigerator a little bit because things are tough, and there's no shame in that whatsoever. Essentially, you or someone else that you know has been caught in the law of unintended consequences. Please pray that people smarter than me get this whole mess figured out. Well, we have a little bit different topic today, something that probably you wouldn't expect to hear about martyrdom, but it is not it ain't Coliseum talk. We're going to be talking with, well, someone who knows about it. Would you sign in, please?
Well, my name is Father Alan Guanella. I am a priest of the Diocese of La Crosse and currently the pastor at Our Lady Queen of Heaven Parish in Wisconsin Rapids, originally from the city of La Crosse.
I'm very familiar with Wisconsin Rapids because I used to work in radio in Marshfield, and I always kind of perk up when I hear about it. There's going to be a data center built, which is certainly a big thing for Wisconsin Rapids.
Absolutely. It'll be at the currently closed down paper mill on the Wisconsin River and using the power of the dam on the Wisconsin River to power the new data center.
Yeah, it's exciting news for Wisconsin Rapids.
It is. It'll be good for the city.
Yeah, it's a nice part of the world.
It is.
It's a very
Central
nice
Wisconsin,
part.
Come and visit.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about martyrdom, and frankly, it's not the kind of topic we talk about all the time. Can you define what a martyr is?
Well, a martyr is someone who has been killed in hatred of the faith. So this is someone, a layman or woman, a priest or a bishop even, who has been killed, assassinated, we might say in political terms, but this is someone who has been killed in hatred of the faith. So it's not for political reasons, it's not for other reasons. This is because the faith that this person professed and lived in his or her life was hated by either another individual or a group or a government even. And because of this hatred, the person was killed in hatred of the faith.
And there have been attempted ones like with Pope John Paul II.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, Father Walieski, servant of God, Father Walieski, had people after him all the time. And there could be reasons why they do it that is involving hating what that person of faith is doing.
Absolutely. So sometimes it involves politics because the political regime in the country or locale is antithetical to the Christian faith. And the person, whether he be a religious person, a religious brother or sister or a priest, that faith that the person has is lived out in their life. And then it's in conflict with whether that be the political regime or anti-Catholic, anti-Christian sentiment that's there at the time.
And again, this isn't just like the Christians in the Colosseum and the lions. This is going on all over the world. Periodically.
Absolutely. The Vatican issues every so often a list of new martyrs. And some of these will eventually become saints in our church. But the Vatican still is involved in looking at who are martyrs, modern day martyrs in the church. And this is throughout the world. This is not just in one locale, but in many parts of the world, there are still modern day martyrs.
One of the martyrs that we are going to talk about today is a local guy.
Absolutely. Brother James Miller, who is from just outside of Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and born in 1944. Brother James Miller was born on a farm just outside of Stevens Point in a little hamlet called Ellis. And there is a white church that's now closed down, St. Martin's Church. That was his home parish right here in Portage County in Wisconsin. And you can go visit that grave of Brother James Miller at the old St. Martin's Church. And the family farm butts right up against the churchyard there.
Where was he? Well, I'm trying to get, how did he get to being where he was when that happened?
Absolutely. So Brother James Miller spent his growing up years like any other young Christian Catholic boy. He was a devout boy and eventually decided to go to Pacelli High School in Stevens Point. And the Christian Brothers, which is a group of religious brothers, the brothers of the Christian schools founded by St. John Baptist de La Salle, operated Pacelli High School in Stevens Point. And that was his first view of the brothers, and decided after a year at Pacelli High School to go to Glencoe, Missouri, and discern with the brothers in their high school program. And so he went to Missouri to spend time with the brothers, and eventually decided to continue on and become a novice in the Christian Brothers. Now, the Christian Brothers as an organization is one that's dedicated solely to teaching. They don't have any priests within their ranks, and they spend their entire life teaching. And so after he went to his college studies at St. Mary's University in Winona, then St. Mary's College, which is my alma mater, in fact, as well. He received a undergraduate degree in modern language. Spanish was his forte. And because of his great love of Spanish, became a Spanish teacher. And there he, after graduating from St. Mary's University, went to Creighton High School in St. Paul, which is now Creighton-Durham Hall. And he taught Spanish. He served as the quartermaster. It was a military school at the time. He was the soccer coach. He was a maintenance supervisor, which gave him the moniker of Brother Fix-It, because he would shovel the snow, he would fix things, he would be walking around the halls with a wrench and tools on his belt and come into the classroom to teach Spanish after having just shoveled all the snow or fixed a bathroom toilet or whatever it might have been. He was a large man, a boisterous man with a great laugh, and taught Spanish there. And then he would go to some sisters who were in the area to practice his Spanish as well, to really learn that Spanish. After a while teaching at Creighton-Durham Hall, then Creighton High School, he received a National Defense Education grant to attend the University of Dayton to study Spanish. And there, after that program and professing his solemn or lifetime vows in the Brothers of the Christian Schools, it was decided that he would go to Nicaragua, Blue Fields, Nicaragua. And that was his first missionary activity, to go down to Nicaragua. And he went to Cristobal Colon High School in Blue Fields, Nicaragua. And what did he do? Well, he taught. He coached soccer, and again, oversaw maintenance. Then, after a little while, went to Puerto Cabezas, Nicaragua. And there he taught English, mathematics, religion. He even taught at the National University, became principal of the school, and while he was there, as the Christian Brothers would do, even helped the local community, founded a volunteer fire department. The students in Polonia, Wisconsin, which is now his home parish, St. Martin's having been closed, the students at Sacred Heart School in Polonia have often been able to look at his old fireman's helmet, and the kids love looking at that old fireman's helmet that he used when he was in Nicaragua. In 1979, he decided to leave Nicaragua to come back to Wisconsin. And this is important because while he wanted to come back, he wasn't able to. He would never return to Nicaragua. The government at the time was corrupt. This is a time of upheaval, political upheaval, of corruption in the government. And it was a difficult time to be a religious person in Nicaragua, in all of South America, for that matter. When asked if he was afraid during the machine gun battles outside of the high school that he was at, Brother James remarked, "Are you kidding? I never knew I could pray so fervently as from under my bed." And so he said when he left in 1979 that he wasn't fleeing, and he had every intention of returning to Nicaragua, but it just wasn't meant to be. He went back to Creighton High School and taught for a while there at Creighton High School, but he realized that his life had been changed as a missionary. He would ruffle the students' pride by criticizing their lack of commitment to their studies. He would say, he's quoted as saying, "How can you waste your opportunities for an education? In Nicaragua, less than 1% ever receive this type of education." And he wrote to one of his fellow brothers that I'm bored in St. Paul. And he said, "The weather's been so cold and I've managed." And he said, "Now I hate snow," which is kind of funny because it's something that, you know, he grew up in the Stevens Point area, was a tough guy who would have been, you know, used to lots of snow. But his time in South America changed all of that. And so after his time at Creighton High School, the Christian Brothers decided to have him take some time as kind of on a sabbatical to discern what was next in his life as a brother. He even had considered leaving the order and becoming a priest, to become a Franciscan priest, a Capuchin Franciscan priest. We had missionaries in South America, but realized that wasn't his vocation either, that it was his vocation to be a teacher, to be a brother. And so in 1981, he was assigned for 3 years to the Colegio de la Salle in Huahuatenango in Guatemala. And so there, his first job was to teach history, but also Guatemalan art, which he said he really had no idea how to teach that at the beginning, but also English as well. But what he became was the sub-director for what was known as the indigenous school, or the Indian school, the Casa Indígena. And this was, he supervised and counseled young indigenous Guatemalans to teach them not only academic subjects, but farming and agriculture, to help them to go back to their villages in the indigenous territory of Guatemala, and then was able to help them bring learning and education to their villages. In February of 1982, there was a plot to get rid of the Colegio's sub-director. Now, there were multiple sub-directors, Brother James Miller being one of them. And this is the same time that you might be familiar with American Father Stanley Rother, who was beatified in 2017 in Oklahoma City. And he was just 100 miles south of Brother James Miller. And Father Stanley Rother was shot and killed in the middle of the night in Guatemala. Well, this plot to kill one of the Colegio sub-director was overheard, and the American Embassy even issued a warning about plans to kill an American in the near future. And I, as I talk about this, I'm reminded about a letter, a very famous letter that Brother James Miller wrote, and he said, "The level of personal violence here is reaching appalling proportions. I'm personally weary of violence, but I continue to feel a strong commitment to the suffering poor of Central America." I pray to God for the grace and strength to serve him faithfully among the poor and oppressed in Guatemala. I place my life in his providence. I place my trust in him. And then on February 13th, 1982, while he was fixing a wall, outside wall on the Casa Indígena, he was shot 6 times. And it's always commented too that St. John Baptist de La Salle, the founder of his order, said, "Your zeal must go so far that you are ready to give your very life, so dear to the youth entrusted to you." And he was shot 6 times. It is said that he was gone by the time he fell off the ladder and hit the ground. The gunman ran towards the police station. And so they said this was most likely the so-called death squad from the government that did not like what he was doing there, did not like the teaching and the faith that he was teaching. And so there was a question, was this done for the faith or was this done for political reasons? And the Vatican strongly said, no, this was hatred of the faith, hatred of what he was doing. And so in 1982, Brother James Miller, a local boy from central Wisconsin, in the prime of his life, was gunned down, martyred in South America. That's a brief history right there of Brother James Miller.
It's probably difficult for most of us in the United States to understand the politicization. I can't even say the words, let alone do it. But the political nature of assassination.
Absolutely.
We see this going on right now. And there's places in Colombia, I believe, and also in Sudan. There's so many of them, I get them mixed up, where a rebel group will do things like burn the crops of the local people before they can harvest them, and then loot the warehouses of all the existing grain to make their lives more miserable. And so they call upon the existing government to help them out, and according the government can't help them. And that's why, of course, the rebels say, you should let us overthrow the government.
Right.
I mean,
right. I've been studying Brother James Miller for a number of years, and even I'm not entirely clear on the whole political situation in Guatemala in the 1980s and all of that. It's a very complicated history. Yeah. But needless to say that Brother James Miller was in the middle of it all. And what he wanted to do was teach and bring the Christian faith and bring the love of Jesus Christ to the young people there at his indigenous school, and that's what he did. And even though there was this plot to get rid of an American or a subdirector, he said, "No, I have to do what I have to do." And so he had a great love of what he did. He was very real in that sense. Sometimes even with the great martyrs, you bring up those martyrs who were, killed in the Colosseum by wild beasts. And we kind of can put some of these martyrs on a pedestal, and we should, as great saints and examples for us to imitate. But Brother James had issues with getting to Mass on time, getting his prayers in, getting overworked by everything that he had to do. And they said, "You need to get your prayers in. You need to get to Mass on time. You need to be able to focus on what's most important as a religious brother." But it was easy for him to keep working and keep teaching and work very hard. And that's why he's very real for us. Not only is he from the Diocese of La Crosse and from central Wisconsin, but he's somebody that we can imitate very, very easily as well, even though we may not be missionaries and we may not be called to be martyrs. And if you would have asked him, I think he would have said, "Well, sure, I'll be a martyr, but that's not going to happen."
Yeah.
But it did. And now we have such a great example in Brother James Miller, the ability to imitate his life as well.
How old did you say he was?
Well, he was born in 1944 and died in 1982. So you can do the math.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll get out.
36, I think.
Okay, yeah, he's in his 30s. So he was really quite the young man and really getting his foothold. And he was ordained when now?
He was not a priest.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me.
Yeah, he was a religious brother.
Right.
The brothers of the Christian schools don't have any priests within their order. They completely give their life over to teaching.
Right.
Especially the poor and underprivileged.
Yeah, I was trying to think, is how long had he been practicing his faith in that particular way? I mean, was he...
Well, right. He professed his lifetime vows shortly before, I think it was 1979, okay, that he went. So it was 1969. Mm-hmm. 1969 is when he professed his final vows.
So he had actually been practicing his faith in that fashion for quite some time.
He did, and most people forget that he spent most of his life as a missionary in Nicaragua. He was only in Guatemala for a short time, but he's most remembered because he was martyred in Guatemala. But he spent most of his time in Nicaragua, and then coming back to St. Paul. To teach at Cretan High School those years as well.
When you're a young guy, you really don't think a lot about the possibility of mortality.
You don't.
You know, and we would not expect that, you know, seminarians be given a course on you could be a martyr.
Right.
You know, I mean, many of us who were in the military joined in very young, you know, times. I was 18, just out of high school. It never occurred to me I might end up getting killed. Because I was 18.
Right. You know. Right. And even, you know, his brothers are still at Sacred Heart Parish in Polonia. Mm-hmm. I was pastor there for a couple of years, and they were ushers at Mass, and I saw them. And, and you know, Brother James would, had he been alive, would probably had been coming home.
Yeah.
And I would have seen him as, you know, a brother from the parish. Mm-hmm. But now he has a much different role in not only the life of his home parish, but in the life of the Diocese of La Crosse and really the life of the church as well. Because he served in the Diocese of La Crosse, the Diocese of Winona, the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis, all of the dioceses that he served in have put him on the local calendar. So on February 13th of each year, they can celebrate the liturgical feast day of Brother James Miller within their dioceses because he has been beatified or blessed by the church. And that's why the church is looking for a miracle. One more miracle attributed to his intercession can then pave the way for him to be declared a saint. And what a wonderful thing to be able to have a local boy from central Wisconsin to be a saint as well. And so there's lots of ways that people can help with that. Number one, pray for his intercession and ask for miracles, especially miraculous healings, which the Vatican would look at if there's any miraculous healings. And then the Christian Brothers have started a new guild, the Brother James Miller Guild, which you can visit at brotherjamesmiller.org and learn more about the guild. You can join the guild. There's different levels of joining. You can look at the resources, articles, texts, lesson plans that are there. And then the guild is offering in-person and online events for educators and all interested in Brother James Miller's cause for canonization. Cause is the technical term that's used, the process for someone to become a saint. So we have to pray to Brother James Miller and ask for his intercession as well. When one of the Christian Brothers was commenting a year after he died, he was giving a talk at St. Mary's University in Winona and said, "It is important that we do not forget Brother James Miller. What he lived for and what he ultimately died for is the gospel message of freedom, peace, justice, and truth." And so we're trying very hard to not let Brother James Miller be forgotten as well, not only as an example for all of us, but someone who we can imitate each and every day in our lives, even if we're not called to be missionaries, even if God doesn't call us to be a martyr. Modern day martyrs still exist. And sometimes there's not the bloody martyrdom of killing, but the daily martyrdom of following Jesus in the public square that isn't always welcoming to Catholics, to Christians. We see that even in our own country, where it's not always welcome or people aren't always happy to have you around.
And that is the saddest thing I've seen. Even in our local area, some years ago now, I don't remember who it was telling me this, but you know, this priest and a couple of sisters, religious, were sitting at some kind of restaurant. You know, nothing particularly fancy. And some other people got up and moved further away.
Mm.
And that's like, are you out of your minds?
Right.
You know, I'm sorry. I repeat this at almost every show, and I'm sorry, folks, if I keep getting boring about this. I have great respect for anybody who devotes this portion of their life, a lot of it, to understanding God and also sharing it with other people. This is a tremendous vocation.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm including you here now.
Right, right. You know, no, I thank you.
Everybody except you, no, Father.
Sure. Right. Well, it's true, isn't it? And sometimes I think people forget that whether you're a religious brother or a religious sister, a priest, a deacon, you sacrifice a great deal to put the collar on, to put the habit on. And we believe that God calls us to it and that he gives us the grace and strength to be able to live that life. But it is not easy. It is not always something we want to do or would necessarily choose ourselves, but it's something that God gives us strength to do.
And I've had priests, I don't know if it was on this show or they were talking about this on this show, but one priest who was dealing with the gangs in East Los Angeles, you know, and this is really some dangerous stuff.
Absolutely.
And we've got other gangs in different parts of the country, and priests are trying to calm the waters, as it were, between the two sides. And you can get between two different groups feuding, and this is tense.
No, if you read the history, especially of the church in the United States, there were a lot of different groups and factions. The church was not always well loved in these United States. And in certain parts of the country, it was the local people were antithetical to the faith. They didn't like the Catholics coming in or certain ethnic groups that were Catholic. And the stories of those original pioneers of the Catholic faith, and especially you look at some of the great American saints and American pioneers, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton and so on, who spent a great deal of time being able to really promote the church and what the church could do for the people. But, you know, Mother Cabrini and all of these wonderful saints, we look at them now with kind of rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. But back then, boy, it was hard. It was a hard life, and it still is a hard life. One of my favorite quotes to comment on in homilies is from Pope St. John the 23rd, who said, "Christian life is a sacrifice. And if we are doing our Christian life the way we're supposed to be doing, there is sacrifice involved. It's not always easy, but God calls us to it. And that's the most important thing, is that God gives us the grace to be able to live our life as faithful Christians."
One thing I was running across somewhere in reading or hearing was something about basically totalitarianism, and they achieve their results by trying to keep people divided, us versus them. And of course, us is going to be this select group, and them is going to be outside the fence, basically.
Absolutely.
And where Christianity comes in and priests come in and Catholicism is to say, no, we are all one. You know, when you see the guy, that's the guy's pointing to him, he's one of them.
Right.
He's less than human. He's one of them. The priest says, no, he's loved by God just like you are. This is not a message that a lot of times people want to hear.
No, not at all. We forget that the name of the evil one, Satan, that word, Satan, means adversary. One who comes up against, who divides. And so when evil comes in, it's there to divide, to break down the unity. And what does our Lord say? He prays that all may be one. And we have to see that in our own life, to kind of examine our conscience. Are we bringing unity into our life, into the lives of those people that we live with and work with and interact with? If we're not bringing unity, perhaps we're not entirely doing what God is asking us to do.
Every once in a while, and I'm not a big YouTube fan. I mean, I look at a couple of groups that have specific interests that I have, not religious and not political, mostly cameras.
Sure.
You know, things like that.
For a radio
person, radio stuff, technical stuff. But they also have these little things called reels that are short produced videos, and most of them are garbage. But some group has been doing one, and I I have to figure they're legitimate, where they find people on the street or just in other circumstances where they have let themselves go.
Sure.
They have given up and they look bedraggled and they look just, their hair is a mess, big bushy beards, men and women, looking really bad. And this, I think in Europe, they bring them into this salon that has volunteered to do this.
Sure, I've seen some of these.
And they do a makeover where they cut their hair and they clean them up. And the women, they do their, they pluck their eyebrows or they eyebrow pencil them. But it's all kinds of, and then they, more or less blindfold them and put them in front of a mirror. And then there's the moment where the person looks at themselves in the mirror and they look fantastic, mm-hmm. right? And I was thinking about this, I said, basically, what we're trying to say is, this is the way God sees you.
Right.
You may look like you're on a street corner with their hair down through your head and all messed up, but inside there is this much more wonderful creature. And we're trying to do a physical thing, but God already sees you.
God already sees it. God, yeah. God looks into the heart.
Yeah. And this is what, the folks at the warming centers do. They see these people coming in and, they try to help them out with getting laundromat stuff there and all these things. But basically, the thing we keep talking about when we talk to them is not ignoring these people. And to be just shunned as if you're a lesser creature that I don't even want to look at.
Right.
It's
and
hard.
It reminds me of something that was written about Brother James Miller. Brother Raymond Long, one of the brothers, wrote that Brother James had a charisma, that there was nothing phony about him. He just enraptured people with his simplicity. And that he was a very intelligent man, but at the same time, a very simple man who was never arrogant. He had a dimension of love that reached out to everyone and made each of us a better person. And that's how we're supposed to live each and every day, is that generosity of spirit. And in a book on the life of Brother James, there's a quote from a former student of his who said that after spending hours in the classroom teaching, he would, go into the hallways as the maintenance man and the janitor, and no work was unworthy of his dignity. He mopped the floors, he scoured the toilets, he cleaned the furnaces, and the students really recognized this quality of service in him. And I mean, that's how we're supposed to be, is that, nothing is beneath our dignity, that we help and that we give of ourselves in generosity, because that's what God asks of us. And he sees us, he sees who we really are. And Bishop Battersby here in the diocese has said, we can't be hypocrites about things. We can't just profess the name of Christian without really doing anything about it. We have to make sure our actions and our words and our life imitate that love of God each and every day.
Yeah, it's very important. I spent about a year and a half training people to do hotel reservations at a call center. And a lot
God
of them,
bless you for that.
Yeah, I know. And, it was a very interesting time. But some of the people had been displaced from the boot factory that
sure.
had closed. And, some of them thought that the job, they were number one. The first thing I was amazed at, these people were smart. They could pick up stuff and they did a good job. I mean, they were maybe putting together boots one time. But within a few weeks, they're running these computers and doing this stuff.
Sure.
They're great. But I also said to them that this job is not, no job is beneath you if you do it with a certain amount of pride. And I mentioned the guy who comes out and pumps our septic tank.
Sure.
Which one would look at going, ugh, the guy is pumping poop. I mean, that's what he's doing. I said, number one, he has to make sure that big truck with the pump on it is in perfect order, because you don't want that thing to go wrong.
You do not.
He also has to be aware of the environmental regulations, as to disposal and all these other things. And it's a precision job
that people rely on each and every day.
And
you're very thankful when he shows up when you need to get that septic pump.
Exactly. And so I do not look upon him poorly in any way, shape, or form. My own father was a bus driver, driving folks between New Jersey and New York, commuters every day, back and forth. Not the greatest job in the world.
No, but I think that's the whole point, right, with the saints that we see in our lives, is that we can put so many of them on a pedestal, and many of them are worthy of that, but there are even more, and so many that we don't even know the names of, who lived simple, good, holy lives.
Yeah.
And are in heaven enjoying the beatific vision with God because they lived their life the way that God intended it. And that's what we have to do each and every day. And we see that from time to time in some of these more obscure saints like Brother James Miller, who isn't very well known outside of the circles of the Diocese of La Crosse or Minnesota or parts of the Christian yeah. Brothers.
And some like some of the jobs they're doing is very menial in some areas, as he was doing. But my father, he drove for, I don't know how many, 25 years, never had an accident. Not a single person that he drove back and forth ever was hurt. I always thought it was very odd, though, that at Christmas time, some of his regular customers would give him a bottle of booze.
Oh, well, that's an interesting. Enjoy it at home.
Yeah, you're the bus driver. But, you know, you have to have some respect for people. And I wonder now, with priests, how much discretion do you have in the kind of job that you do? I know you get assigned to parishes and things.
We do.
But we had, for example, you know, Monsignor Hirsch, who eventually wanted to be a missionary down at Casa Hogar to follow in the steps of Father Walieski. And I'm sure he probably had to petition to do this.
Right. Well, and sometimes it's a petition from the priest to the bishop. Other times the bishop will call up and say, I really have this job, this ministry that I would like you to take for the diocese, for the good of the church. Now, all priests promise obedience to their bishop. Diocesan priests attached to a diocese like myself or Monsignor Hirsch promise that we'll serve within the diocese. And so assignments outside of the diocese are more at our discretion, but sometimes it might come from ourselves, it might come from the bishop, or in the case of Casa Hogar, which is a ministry operated by the Diocese of La Crosse. Religious priests who belong to a religious order, like the Franciscans or the Dominicans, promise obedience to their bishop as a priest, but their religious superior, they make a vow of obedience, and that's a stronger thing. And so they often don't have much say in it. But that promise of obedience for a diocesan priest ultimately comes down to, if the bishop asks you to go somewhere, you are obedient and you say yes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you can't have some ideas or you might have thoughts about what the bishop says, or the bishop might ask you, what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Do you speak Spanish or how's your Latin or something like that? I'm a canon lawyer. I was asked to study canon law at the Catholic University of America. I was sent there by our emeritus bishop, Bishop Callahan. He called one day and asked me to go, and I said yes, and that changed my life because of that. And now I work in the tribunal here in the diocese as well, and that was another phone call from the bishop. You know, would you work in the tribunal in marriage cases and other canonical things that come in? And so happy to do it. It's the life of a priest is a life of obedience. But in doing the will of God, we also find our hope. We find our joy as well. And it's not just the happiness of emotional happiness, but true joy and the joy that doesn't go away.
Yeah. You may or may not have heard Bishop Callahan's story about how he got the call to go to Milwaukee. It's in our show number one, and it's still on there out of 650-something shows. He was told to go to visit some archbishop or cardinal's office at a particular time when he goes there. And at that time, he was a spiritual director at the North American College. Mm-hmm. And the cleric says to him, Bishop Callahan, the Holy Father has asked you to go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin to be auxiliary bishop. And he leans into him and he goes, and how do you answer the Holy Father? it was great. But I'm wondering, though, also, on a more serious note, if you are asked to be assigned to a dangerous area, and or they ask you.
Sure.
Either way. Is there any briefing that they do? Do they have any kind of briefing? They say, we need to tell you about this area. Here are these factions doing this and this group's doing
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Okay. Especially in those communities, religious communities that have operations, have works in those dangerous areas. Mm-hmm. It's less of diocesan priests who go to this. Our call as diocesan priests is to work in dioceses, in parishes, in schools, hospitals, within a diocese. But especially for those religious communities that are missionaries or their very nature is to go out to some of those areas where the faith might not be very strong or where there are dangerous places. There's briefings, there's different ways that they, you know, keep safe. There are priests in China, and that's a different situation as well, with a government that's not entirely welcoming to the Catholic Church. It's a unique relationship between the Church and the Chinese Communist Party. There are many religious orders in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South America, that have very wonderful work and strong charism in those areas, but it's all very difficult work.
Yeah. I have a young in-law, my wife's side of the family, obviously, who finally got his dream wish. He's just been assigned to work at the American Embassy in Beijing, and he's a lawyer, and he wanted to do this. He has been extensively trained, not only in Chinese, but also in counterintelligence, because he says, you've got someone who walks up and wants to kind of be your friend. Probably they're going to be a spy. And he has learned how to do defensive driving to lose a tail.
Oh, sure.
And even how to properly crash through a gate if he has to.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is because it's that environment is hostile.
Right. Many people might not be aware that the Holy See, that is the Vatican, has diplomatic posts in almost all countries in the world. And these diplomatic posts are run by diplomats of the Vatican, many who are priests. I have two classmates of mine from seminary who are overseas in the diplomatic corps. The ambassadors of the Vatican, which are known as nuncios, are mostly archbishops, and they live their life in far-flung places at the service of the whole Church and really at the service of the Holy Father. And so it is not an easy life. And you know, we're all called to be missionaries in missionary spirit. That's something that you know, we learned from Father Joe Walieski, that I'm sure Monsignor Hirsch has talked about on this program and others as well, that we are all called to be missionaries and to live a missionary life with a missionary spirit. Most of us aren't called to go overseas and spend a great deal of time overseas, but we can live that missionary spirit each and every day in bringing the love of Jesus Christ and the witness of the gospel, the good news that the gospel is, to others, and then praying fervently for those who are overseas, are serving as missionaries, who are in harm's way. I think of Brother James Miller, who he said he was under his bed praying while the machine gun battles were going out. I mean, it's not like you can just pick up and leave.
Yeah.
You know, this is your assignment. This is where God wants you. And yet, you know, machine gun battles going on.
Right. And there can be those who stir up the locals against you for completely false reasons, you know, misinformation, disinformation, that kind of thing going on. So it's really, I think, we keep talking about how there is kind of a skimming the surface of the water perception of priests.
Right.
You know, they do a homily on Sunday and relax the rest of the week.
Yeah. Come to my parish and see everything that we do during the week.
The amount of work that is done by the average parish and the average parish priest, social things, you know, we've had some talk about having kind of a network so we can identify people in rural areas who are having a tough time.
Sure.
So that Catholic Charities or others can help them and things like that. All kinds of work that goes on. And I've frequently talked about the idea that when the average priest has certain things they do and talents and organization skills pretty much that many CEOs would be jealous of having.
Well, and it's also that God calls us to things that we may not have been entirely certain of ourselves.
Yeah.
Working in hospitals or with the dying, the aged, working with young people, working in parishes and those who are getting married or those who are going through difficult marriages. And God calls us to this and he gives us the grace and strength, and we are trained as well. I mean, it takes a long time to become a priest. Seminary is not a quick program, but it's with God's help and God's grace that we're able to do all of this. And we never know what God is calling us to or where he's calling us to. And that's really the openness to the movement of the Holy Spirit as a priest, but also whether you're a religious brother or sister, it's the same thing. And lay people as well. You know, there's one priest, perhaps two, maybe in a parish, but it's the lay people in the parish that make up all of the hard workers. Without the people, there isn't much of a parish. In canon law, we learned that a parish is a certain group of the people of God. It's not necessarily the building. That's a church. But a parish is a group of the people of God, a portion of the people of God. And so together, those people make up the parish. I interview candidates for confirmation, you know, sophomores in high school, and I always tell them, you may not live in this community the rest of your life, but someday you might be married, you have a family, get involved in that parish where you find yourself. Without the people, that parish can't thrive. And so get involved. I always encourage them to that every parish, every Catholic parish is their home. They may only be familiar with the ones in their home place, but get involved, stay involved, because the priest relies on those people to run the parish. Whenever somebody would come to me and say, oh, Father, I have a great idea and present something, I said, I like that idea. You take care of it.
There you go. The volunteers are the muscle of the church
to
get things done. And this idea of if you move out of your home parish to get involved in your parish is a new place, make sure your kids go too.
Absolutely.
Right now, there's so much talk about kids just being disassociated with real people, let alone with religious stuff.
Right.
And you got to get them back in. You got to get them to not spend quite so much face time with kind of odd friends and stuff like that.
Right. People talk to me all the time about, you know, their children don't go to Mass or they don't participate in the life of the parish anymore. And this can really be a heartache on people, especially if they raise them in the faith and they took them to Mass every week. And I say, remember St. Monica, who prayed for her son Augustine, prayed for years, for decades, that he might return or really find the faith and find Jesus Christ. And now we have St. Augustine, one of the greatest saints we have in the church. But that's because St. Monica prayed for him for decades, 30 years. And so don't lose heart if your children have a hard time practicing the faith. Keep praying. You know, teach them by example, encourage them. You can't force them anymore,
no.
But you have to keep praying for them. That's the most important thing.
Yeah. And you can show them what people in the church are doing. That, you know, maybe these people are really big into ecology and you know, global warming and all. Well, here, look at what these people are doing over here where they have this this drive to collect stuff or do whatever. You know, there's people doing good stuff in the church that you can also work alongside. Real people, not just names on a screen.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, if you come to a parish, you go talk to the pastor or any priest who's there with a plan for something already organized, that pastor or priest is going to say, great idea. You take care of that. I would love to have it in my parish.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's hard for the priest to come up with the ideas. It's hard for the priest to make sure that everything goes smoothly. But it comes from the people. And so get involved and offer opinions and thoughts.
Some of these, you know, early teens, they can have coat collections in the winter and do all kinds of other things they should do. Well, the vehicle that can help you do that is the church.
Absolutely. And people, you know, people get involved in different ways and they have different things that speak to their hearts in different ways. And that's how we're made by God. We're made in different ways and different things speak to our hearts and different things pull us or tug us in different ways. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, follow that. That's God. Way of doing things in your heart and helping others based on your initiative as well.
Now, I may have asked you this last time you were here. I maybe didn't. When did you really feel you had a vocation to the priesthood?
Well, this is always a great question to ask any priest or a bishop about, you know, how they felt a call to be a priest. And our former bishop, now just the retired Archbishop of Milwaukee, Archbishop Jerome Listecki, he and I would be classified, he came up with this, or maybe he stole it from somebody, a womb-to-tomb priest. So I had a thought of being a priest from a very young age. I was perhaps in second grade, 8 years old or something like that. And it was always in the back of my mind that I might become a priest. Certainly there were other things. I had thought about being a scientist, a teacher. There were other sorts of things that came up and came into my thoughts. But as I grew up and I got older, especially in high school, and then was able to visit the seminaries that the diocese sent to, spend time with priests, talk to priests and discern, I decided to enter the seminary right out of high school. So I graduated from high school and went right into college seminary right after graduation from high school. So that's not the norm. You know, there's a few of us womb to tomb priests out there, but I was one who, it was always the slow, quiet voice of God. There was no great blinking neon sign from heaven, as they say. There was no great conversion or reversion in my life. It was always just the quiet speaking of God to my heart from when I was very little. I had good family members who supported me. I had good examples in priests throughout my life as well.
I think Archbishop Lisecki was on this show, a previous version of this show, and he talked about how when he was very little, he would borrow a big wine glass or something from the, you know, with a stem on it from the cupboard, and he had Necco wafers.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and I had those too to play Mass.
Yeah, I think if we didn't have Necco wafers, I think that could have had a real bad impact.
Oh, well, right. I suppose you could use Oreos, but that...
No, the Necco wafers, yeah. They had that nice snap when you break them in half.
No, yeah. I celebrated, you know, played Mass in my grandmother's living room with the piano bench as my altar.
Oh, very, very good.
I remember one time my mother and my grandmother were chatting, and apparently I had to tell them, ladies, you're talking during Mass, because they were talking during my Mass. Yeah, and so apparently I was giving a sermon or something. I don't know.
That's very good. And they probably had a pretty good idea where you were headed.
I think so.
That's very good.
So.
That's very good.
My grandfather said I would either do something with computers or become a priest, and so I became a priest.
And nowadays you can be doing both at the same time. There's plenty of room for that, too.
As we stare around this table with computers.
That lined up everywhere. Yes, here they are. Well, Father, we had a good hour talking about this. It's good of us to keep remembering Brother James Miller, because he, a local guy who was just doing what he loved and out of the blue.
Absolutely.
Happened.
No, visit brotherjamesmiller.org for more information. If you're in central Wisconsin on Highway 66, there's the little white church of St. Martin's in Ellis in between Stevens Point and Rosholt, just 2 miles before you get to Polonia. And there in that churchyard are the remains in the grave of Brother James Miller. You can visit that anytime.
Great. Can you leave us with a prayer and a blessing?
Sure. Almighty God, we ask your blessing upon us as we gather today. Help us to live our life in the way that you would want us to live it, to be missionaries in spirit and in truth. We ask this through Christ our Lord. And may the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down on you, remain with you forever. Amen.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you.
Back in the days of the old Soviet Union, whenever some factory that was producing tractors or whatever didn't get quite up to their specifications, they didn't produce enough tractors like they were supposed to in the five-year plan, there was always the excuse it was wreckers, individuals who were secretly sabotaging the fine work of their staff. They were wreckers. Well, in the past week or two, as you I'm sure know, there are now ad hoc groups that have come out of nowhere. They have been looking for kind of financial wreckers, the people wasting money from the U.S. government. And very recently, they have taken shots at both the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church, suggesting somehow that the money given to them to work with the poor has been misused and wasted. Even vague comments about sort of money laundering and diverting funds for other uses. Well, along with Cardinal Timothy Dolan, I also wasn't particularly happy to hear that. It's totally outrageous. As I've said before, the government allots money to places like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services because they can do a more efficient job than if the government tried to start from scratch and rebuild the whole thing at their particular office. And what's even more absurd is you can go to the financial records that are published every year as to how they spend their money, where it comes in, where it goes, and you will see that, for example, Catholic Charities spends millions of dollars more than they get. That extra money comes from people making donations. Whenever there's a frenzy over something, misinformation and bad information take hold. In this particular case, there are people who just don't like religion, don't like the Catholics, don't like the Lutherans, and sometimes they make easy targets because they don't often push back. Now, I don't speak officially for our bishop or the Diocese of La Crosse, but if you want to see total panic, just imagine what life would be like if places like Catholic Charities suddenly went dark. Please try to fight rumors with facts, because after all, you don't want to see Catholic Charities go away. You don't miss the water till the well goes dry. Jack Zosia here with you on the last few minutes of Connecting the Diocese, a production of the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. You can always hear some of our earlier shows by going to diolc.org/connecting. And also, each show that we do now is also up on the internet as a podcast. If you go to one of the main podcasting venues and type in Connecting the Diocese, you should be able to find it quite easily. We try very hard to get it up on the weekend that we also broadcast it. If you want to go back and hear a show again, then I would suggest that you go to diolc.org/connecting, and you can see a listing there where you can play them at no charge. You don't have to sign in or give us your password, and also you can download them if you wish. And you can also connect with us by dropping us a note at connecting@diolc.org. That's connecting@diolc.org. I spent some time this week thinking about Brother James Miller and his sacrifice, and also some various phrases and things that have been said that seem to do a good job of helping me explain the world around me, or at least dealing with the world around me. Somebody wrote, "When I was a young man, I was deeply impressed by people of power and wealth. When I was a middle-aged man, I was very impressed by people who were clever and brilliant. Now that I'm an older man, you know what I'm impressed by? People who are kind." We get all kinds of people on this show who are kind. Kind with their hearts, kind with their time, kind with their wallets. It does seem at times like kindness is in short supply in this world, but maybe we just haven't looked carefully. Do you remember the fellow Rodney King? He was an African-American man who back in 1991 was severely beaten by Los Angeles police. Well, he was certainly no saint. He did not deserve the degree of beating or beating at all that he got. The result of the coverage of that severe beating inflamed the residents of the Los Angeles area, the black community. There were riots, places were burned. It was very similar to what was going on in Minneapolis. And here's Rodney King. He is seeing all this going on. And, you know, was he looking at it going, "Boy, they're getting back what they deserve for what they did to me"? No, that wasn't at all what he said. I remember him saying this and hearing this and just going, what an amazing man. He looked at all this destruction and all the harm going on, and he simply said, "Can't we all just get along? Can't we all just get along?" Subsequently, that phrase has become the joke phrase in movies and the joke phrase on comedies where, you know, people are arguing over where they're going to go, which Chinese restaurant they're going to go to, and someone goes, "Oh, look, can't we all just get along?" To take such a sincere emotion and turn it into just something funny doesn't speak well for our society. What a wonderful phrase, getting along. Yeah, me helping out you, you helping out me. Maybe I'm a Jew, maybe you're a Palestinian, maybe you and I come from opposite sides of a border, maybe you and I don't have the same exact political views, but we put them aside when it comes time to help out a neighbor, or have a barbecue, or go to church. I actually thought that during the pandemic, that would be the kind of national emergency, death-dealing thing that would cause us to get along. And I was disappointed that it really didn't. You see, it's so much easier to rattle off the ways that you can't get along than the ways that you can. But It isn't productive. It doesn't result in anything good. So thanks, Mr. Rodney King, for your good words. I hope to be as smart a man as you were. We'll see you next week on Connecting the Diocese.